Travel writer Redmond O'Hanlon has survived the Amazon, Borneo, the Congo. This time around, he headed out to the icy Atlantic off the coast of Scotland for a stint on a deep-sea trawler. His vessel faced sleepless nights, dangerous seas, and the isolation of being alone at sea. O'Hanlon writes about his experience in the book Trawler. He told Steve Paulson that devastating accidents were a way of life on the high seas.
When I'd left this boat, about a month later, the youngest man, Sean, who I really like, but he cut his thumb off at the gutting table with one of those really sharp knives. Now, you don't stop for that. That's not even reported as an accident. And worse, a month after that, the next oldest, Jerry, he caught his hands in a hawser and a winch, and Jason rang me up and said that Jerry'd lost several fingers. So I rang Robbie, who'd looked after me, sort of decky, and said, well, how many fingers did Jerry lose? And Robbie said, I lost 6 3/4. and that's not an accident either. But at least that story has a happy ending, because Jerry came to a reading I did in Edinburgh, and he has a job teaching very disturbed, very violent boys in Glasgow, albeit in a primary school. And I wasn't thinking. I said, God, Jerry, that must be really tough. And he said, oh, no, they're sweet young men, and when I smell trouble coming, I show them a stump, he said.
So is the real danger getting maimed with the equipment, or is it having your boat sink?
It's having your boat sink. I mean, it wasn't being maimed with the equipment that really worried me, but this endless, ghastly onslaught. I thought, what a truly foul way to die. And it's such a common way to die in the far north there that the bad part of me thought, well, you might get a little paragraph in the Times in London and half a page probably in the Shetland Times, but... What a foul way to go, and so full of fear that you really can't master. I mean, I was comparing it with the fear in a jungle. I mean, in a particular instant, I'm thinking about got to a Yanomami Shabono, and there'd been a lot of violence, but some tribal warfare, I suppose you'd call it. Anyway, I looked up, crawling in through this entrance into the stockaded oval communal living place, and my first thought was, my God, that is the genuine arrow point. That's the arrow point. It's a man-killing point that Chagnon describes. And then I looked up this 6-foot-long shaft of this arrow, and on the way I could see that this warrior had his foreskin tied flat against his stomach with a length of twine. And I thought, these are the real people. And then I thought, my God, he's going to kill me. But even then, a part of me was thinking, well, what a classy way to go. You know, I knew that these arrows can actually pick you up and pin you to the bark of a tree. All this is man on man. It's flattering. This man's taking the trouble to kill me. The danger's out there. It's all very real. Whereas the threat, constant thought of drowning in this Force 12, I really didn't have a mechanism to deal with that.
And you mentioned various superstitions that these trawlermen have. For instance, no one's supposed to wear any green.
That's right. You mustn't say, when you're on board, you must never say pig or rabbit or dog or rat or even salmon. I think anything that reminds you of life ashore. But also, you're absolutely right, you mustn't wear green. So you fall overboard and you drown. Well, you're probably wearing green boxer shorts. So what does that tell you? It tells you that there's a spirit of the sea, there's a God out there, there's something that not just cares about your speech, it cares about your dress sense. It's absolutely one-to-one. It brings terror down to size.
Now, it's worth pointing out that when you went out on this trawler, you were in your 50s. So everyone else on the crew was half your age. You had had virtually no experience at sea before this. Did you feel a little foolish out there?
Yeah, very foolish, but they were very kind to me. Yes, that's another thing I wasn't prepared for. They're all very young, in their late teens, 20s. Only the skipper himself was 32. But I soon found out why that was the case. In this new fishery, and indeed in some of the others, I suspect, you get at most 1 hour's sleep in a block of 1 hour. The brain never has time for a 90-minute full sleep cycle. And you'll get, sometimes we had 1 hour's sleep in 36 because the nets being shot, the hulls coming in, you're gutting. And it's very, very strange and disturbing. I think because the brain can't organize itself by dreaming, you talk, just incessant talk. You feel that your subconscious has flopped out on the galley table or on the gutting room table for everyone to see. The only comfort is that these men are doing just the same. It's not something that you can resist.
Why can't you sleep more? Why can't you go for four or five hours at a time?
You have to gut the catch that's just come in. Meanwhile, the skipper's shot the net, and then so often, before you've even finished gutting the first catch, the big hopper is full of fish that you have to then deal with. So it goes on night and day. There's no stopping. And this skipper was a particularly brilliant fisherman, so he would drop his net into exactly the right canyon. He knew what he was doing. So it would have been better to have somebody incompetent or old, and then we would have had a little rest between hauls.
What's the mark of a really good skipper?
Well, I think Jason Schofield, he was apparently one of the very best skippers there are. He kept calm during all the moments of crisis, but at the same time, he moved fast as a ghost, as they'd say, when there was trouble, and he cared about his crew. The only thing, he got all his anxieties. He owned £2 million to the bank, which is why we had to go out into this hurricane of force 12, in fact. But he'd got it all sized down to the rubber gloves you wear to gut with. You must never, ever ask for another pair. He'd shake with anxiety and say, but I paid full price for the gloves, and every other skipper would make you pay for your own gloves, and there's £8.53, he'd say. But you have to remember these guys ashore. I mean, I'd only before met trawlermen ashore in Orkney and Shetland. Strong, silent, big, muscled Vikings. You know, the toughest guys you'd ever set eyes on. And they don't speak. You know, if somebody puts three sentences together, especially if one of those sentences has the slightest content about your feelings, and even more importantly, if you've put three consecutive sentences together and actually uttered them to your wife, word will get round. You are certainly a homosexual, and you'll not be allowed in the bar.
Yeah, we talked about how dangerous this business is and how a lot of people lose limbs, if not their lives, and at one point, fairly early in the book, you write about a small accident you had. I'm wondering if you could read that passage.
Oh, yes, I will. Yes, well, I didn't think it was a small accident at all, of course, but they did. Well, we're in the gutting room, and there are big conveyors and steel tubes and belts and revolving tables. And Luke wants me to go and get a red fish basket lashed up for to put his specimens in, because he's a scientist on board with me. And in fact, the only way of my getting on board this trawler at all was I eventually had to go as in the lowest civil service rank, which is assistant to a student. Anyway, we're in there, and the storm's not too bad, but it's still going on. Intending to clamber over the 3-foot sides of the conveyor, I began to try to hitch up the civilian trousers beneath my oilskin trousers. There seemed to be so many belts and braces and rubber straps, and the whole outfit was so uncomfortable, and it was so difficult to keep everything up around a moving flop of stomach when the world would not stay still. And besides, my boxer shorts, long ago half shredded by jungle mould, had now decided to give up altogether and to drop dying around my knees. And then, for the second time, and once again, so gently, without warning, so slowly, I was weightless, I was airborne. The conveyor belt passed beneath me. Someone shot me in the left shin. The travelling wave of froth and foam came curling up to wash over me and to leave me splayed out full length against the rusty plates of the port side of the inner hull. "Wow," said Luke, as half getting to my feet, I was slung back across the floor to the side of the conveyor. "You flew," he said, helping me over it. "You flew! I told you! Stand at right angles to a roll! Never face right into it!" And then, as I held on to the side of the circular table, he said, marginally more sympathetic, "Are you hurt?" He stood to my left, a basket in either hand, just as if he was about to go off and do something sensible, like, say, picking up potatoes in some thoroughly stable, reliable, muddy field. I'm not sure," I said, confused, fumbling with my boot and socks, rolling up my 2 pairs of trousers. "I nearly broke a leg." Luke laughed. It was a kindly laugh. The merriment, I reflected ruefully, of a lifeboatman who'd seen it all. Real injuries, who'd probably pulled sailors from the sea with no legs left at all. "It's nothing," I said, inspecting a 3-inch gash, horrified by the volume of blood running down into my socks. "It's a scratch." "It's a 3-inch surface cut," said Luke. "No problem. No rough dressing. You caught your leg on the edge of the conveyor. I saw it all. You flew. But you'll be amazed. Cuts like that, even proper cuts, they heal so fast. It's the salt, I suppose. It's not like your jungle. There's no infection. No land bacteria can survive. Out here, everything heals."
Redmond O'Hanlon. He's the author of the book Trawler, and he talked with Steve Paulson.